Mari.
Go, go, go. Go ahead, Armand. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. In the studio with me today, three great people. Sherry Siegel, who co-hosts with me on Wednesday, was able to make a connection. Sherry, why don't you introduce Dr. Ledoux?
Hi, Armand. And you probably remember that we went to a really interesting conference on music and the mind earlier this year at Purchase College. At that conference, Dr. Ledoux gave a great talk on emotions and the brain. Dr. Ledoux is the director and professor of neuroscience and psychology at the Nathan Klein Institute in Orangeburg, New York. He has written a number of books, and one of them is called The Emotional Brain. Other titles include The Synaptic Self, and papers include The Self from Soul to Brain. All of them really different and interesting. And today we're going to talk about how the brain evolved emotions and how important emotions are to the survival of our species. I mean, you can hear about feelings in moony pop songs and soap operas. To most, they're just formless ideas that stir a vague something in the heart. But to brain scientist Dr. Ledoux, they're not formless ideas, but actual brain functions that have evolved along with other human traits. Emotions like fear, for example, have really helped the species survive. And today on The Positive Mind, we're going to explore how scientists have discovered that feelings are vital to a species' survival and how they can actually be seen in the brain.
Joe Ledoux also has his own unique way of approaching things. He's one of these people, when he goes to his physical doctor says, "How are you keeping yourself so healthy?" Because he's found a balance in his life, a balance between music and his science. And when I talk about science, he does neuroscience, he does brain science, he works with mice. He does that real gritty, bottom line stuff. Stuff I used to do, stuff I know about. Then he started something else, and he started singing what he knew. And he started singing what he knew, especially singing about the conflict in the mind. Now, here's our question always. What runs you? What runs your mind? Is the weather going to affect you so much that you could have a bad mood? Could you be premenstrual, or could you be over-testosteroned, and that's going to dominate your mood? Is the neurochemicals and the hormones going to be the thing that call the shot, as some people believe? Isn't there no such thing as an emotion, a real feeling? We don't know. Joseph addresses this issue. So I welcome Joe Ledoux and the amygdaloids, theory of the mind, meaning the name of the group that's produced the CD, which is now available on Amazon, which I just downloaded. So let's go with Joe Ledoux, and I'm going to go to him with a question. Let's start it right off, Joe, so we could, instead of doing it the usual way, as a scientist would be doing, which would be dry and boring, show me, how did you get to this song that you're about to play?
Well, I'm going to play a song called Crime of Passion, and on the CD we're really fortunate to have a backup singer that most of you have probably heard of, Roseanne Cash, singing my backup vocals on this particular song. And the song is called Crime of Passion, and it was stimulated by a letter I got from someone on death row. This person had committed a murder. He'd murdered his wife, and he was trying to find some way to have the court reconsider his case, and he wanted to use something that is becoming popular called the amygdala defense, which is, I didn't do it, my amygdala did. Well, I didn't, you know, I wrote him a kind letter saying, I'm sorry, I can't really help you because there's no way that I can know for sure whether you did it or your amygdala or some other part of your brain did it. Though in principle, it's possible for the brain to commit behaviors, to execute behaviors that are outside of consciousness. But anyway, it stimulated a song, and I'm going to play that song for you right now. Sentenced to death for a crime I did commit. I couldn't stop, I did it in a fit of anger and pain, of sorrow and fate, of torture and trouble, of misery and fate. Come to me, nectar to a bee, my source of life, my loving wife. I saw you with him, I was hurting and enraged. I couldn't stop once my brain was engaged. A crime of passion has got me locked in this dirty old cell. A crime of passion has got me lost in a living hell. If I could go back, I wouldn't kill for you. You're not worth what I'm going through. So that's the first half of the song. It's kind of a long song.
That's kind of a beautiful thing. You're not worth what I'm going through. It's like so many men I know and so many women I know feel that way. What did I do? How did I get lost in this thing? What is romance? Is it a crime of passion? Is it something you do that you got to pay for afterwards? What's happening in the divorce courts? You know, oh, why were we married in the first place? So you ask this question, Joseph, and you ask it beautifully, and I think your music portrays it beautifully as well. But let's get an idea of the setting that you work in first. What do you do?
Well, I run a lab at NYU. That's my main job. The Emotional Brain Institute at the Nathan Kline Institute is an ancillary or satellite facility where I also do some research. But the day-to-day activities involve supervising a lot of students and postdocs that are studying fear and anxiety in rats, and we're trying to get into the nitty-gritty of the way the brain works, down to the cells and molecules and synapses and proteins and genes and all of that that makes fear come about.
And so what you're learning and what you study is that fear is a function of the amygdala, or fear is a function of the neurochemistry. What makes fear happen? Why does one person get frightened by snakes and another one doesn't?
So let me first address the question of what fear or any other emotion
sure.
is, because that is sometimes a bit confusing. So when we use the term fear or love or any other emotion, we're basically talking about several things. The two primary ones are the bodily expression of the emotion, the way we act in a certain emotional situation or react in an emotional situation, and also the feeling that we have. So many people, myself, Antonio Damasio, and others, separate the concept of feeling from the concept of emotion. Emotions are, we talk about, as the evolutionarily based hardwired systems that are in the brain to help keep you alive. So you have systems for detecting danger, for finding things that are useful to eat and avoiding things that are bad to eat, for finding and interacting with mates, for any of the kinds of things that we normally think of as survival functions. So the The brain is wired to do that in every organism, the smallest, creepiest little sea creature all the way to a complex human, has to have the ability to, for example, to detect danger and respond to danger. A bacteria has to be able to detect danger and respond to danger. If you have a petri dish filled with bacteria and you squirt acid in that dish, all the bacteria will move to the other side because that's bad for them. They know how to protect themselves. So starting from that simple response, all the way from a human jumping back from a bus or jumping out of a swimming pool if someone pours acid in the swimming pool, it's the same basic survival mechanism that is increased in complexity over zillions of years of evolution. Now, when the bacteria are running away from the acid, they're not feeling afraid because they don't have a complex nervous system that could construct a feeling. They are physically responding. And that explanation of a physical response to danger accounts for 99.9% of the instances of responses to threats in the animal kingdom, and including in people. Most of our responses to threats are unconscious, implicit detection and response, and only after the fact do we become conscious of it. So when you jump back from the bus, your brain has detected a large, rapidly moving object. The object is moving towards you fast and it's big. That's all your brain needs to know in order to generate that fear response of jumping back, and then you say, oh, my God, my heart's beating. That scared the shit out of me. Excuse me. But the brain is able to do that without having to be conscious of it. And those are the mechanisms that we've evolved, whether it's for procreation, threat detection, fighting back in situations of danger, finding food, and so forth. All of these are innate, hardwired systems. Now, when the brain becomes aware that one of these systems is active and interprets that activity, that's when you have a conscious experience. And only a brain that's capable of interpreting those states in an integrated way is able to have a conscious experience. So my personal opinion is we need the prefrontal cortex, which is the most highly developed part of the brain in the human, to provide an integrated representation of the emotion. So we can have, for example, let's say there's an apple on the table. So in order to know that that's an apple, you have to perceive, you have to consciously, you have to sense the stimulus being there. So you have to have sensory input about the stimulus. That sensory input has to go into long-term memory and retrieve the template of fruit and apple and that it's something to eat and so forth. And those two things, the sensation and the memory, form the perception. So now you have a conscious perception of an apple. Now, if eating an apple had made you sick last week, when you look at that apple, in addition, you're going to have kind of a nauseous state that is also added to those two things. And in my theory of consciousness or emotional consciousness, those three things come together. The sensation, the memory, and the emotional state of the brain are integrated in working memory in the prefrontal cortex, and that is our feeling about that apple.
Well, now if we take that just a step further, if you were talking about meeting somebody, and you meet somebody for the first time, you're going to retrieve the same thing. You see a person standing there, and the person looks attractive, but they happen to have a mustache. And the mustache goes, your brain goes back and says mustache association. And everything else may be good, or some person has really nicely defined muscles. And you go back to association with that. You find associations from everywhere, whether it be from Playboy magazine or from your experience.
Right.
And that determines your response.
Yes. So let me give you an example that I often use in my lectures, that one of the things we've discovered in terms of the brain pathways of fear is that there are two ways to get to the amygdala if you're a sensory stimulus. One is you come through the normal channel, let's say from the eyes into the thalamus of the brain, which is the gateway into the cortex. And that's been the traditional way that this was thought about for decades and maybe centuries, and then from the cortex to the amygdala. Now, what we discovered very early on when I started doing this research in the 1980s is that there's a shortcut, that the information can get from the thalamus directly into the amygdala without going to the cortex. So you can have a rapid response to danger without knowing exactly what you're responding to, or even before you know what you're responding to.
Like an aversion, you mean?
Well, again, using the bus coming and jumping back.
That's not an aversion, right?
Right. Well, it's aversive. It's dangerous. So you see it.
But you might have it standing at the edge of a platform of a train.
Right.
You might find yourself stepping back before the train comes.
Absolutely.
And that could be aversive.
Right.
Because of other same, this other kind of a simulation
right.
like that.
So let me go back to the example now. So let's say you're having lunch with a friend, and there's a red and white checkered tablecloth on the table. You have an awful fight. And the next day you're walking down the street, and you see someone, and you say, this guy, I don't like him. There's something, my gut tells me I don't like this person. And you don't know why. You look, maybe it's his face or his body build, or as you were saying. So you just automatically say, I trust my gut, and that's the final word. But it turns out he had a necktie made out of red and white checks. And through this low road from the thalamus to the amygdala, that triggered your emotional response, while the high road was looking at the face and the body and kind of like looking for the meaning, whereas the low road, it triggered the emotion. Once the emotion is triggered, then the cortex says, oh, what's the explanation? It's his body shape. It's his eyes. It's his face. So these kinds of low-level signals can get into our emotional systems, trigger emotions, and then we consciously interpret them after the fact.
And you can be born with them, too. I mean, genetically, you could be born with some kind of an aversion that tells you for survival. I know a man who says to me he always scares babies, and he's an unusually large man.
Mm-hmm.
And babies always look at him with fear and apprehension, kind of waiting to see what happens, but they're not going to respond too
right.
positively. They have an automatic fear response.
Yes, so there are things that are built into our nervous system, like our ancestors suffered from predation from spiders and snakes. So those are common things that we develop phobias to. Heights, monkeys living in trees, if they fall asleep in the tree and fall out, it's very dangerous. So they have this wariness of heights. Large objects are dangerous, as we're talking about a large moving object coming towards you.
It's going to eat you up if you're a baby.
Yeah, anything big and oversized, potential, if it falls on you, it's going to kill you, could be built in. So the brain doesn't have to have all of the information. It only needs really cues that have been associated either through evolution or through personal experience with danger in the past. So, for example, an example of a very simple cue that triggers an amygdala response as measured by brain scans is the face. So if you see a fearful face, that will activate the amygdala. But careful studies have shown that it's not the face per se, it's the eyes. And it's not even the eyes, it's the whites of the eyes, the shape of the whites of the eyes. So you can take the whites of the eyes just as an abstract image in fear versus joy or attraction, and show those to people, and the whites of the eyes in fear will drive the amygdala like nothing else.
Well, how will the whites be different? Would they be more whites, less whites?
It's the contour and the amount of pupil that fills it up, you know.
So if there's more pupil filling it up, there's
I don't remember exactly which
less
way it
whites.
Goes.
Less whites. Because, I mean, I'm just thinking about getting eye white makeup so that you don't scare people.
Well, that's not going to work.
Or getting some kind of lens that you can put in
there.
Yeah,
you can put a lens in, right.
That makes you look perfect.
Right.
We would have discovered that by now. So is there a valid, pure response to anything?
Well,
pure like you never had the response before, you got no history associated.
Yeah, I mean
it.
that's always a tough question to nail down, because you know we know that from the moment of fertilization of the egg is subject to environmental influences, which is the chemicals surrounding in the egg. So I mean, obviously the egg is a cell from the mother, and that cell has the mother's cytoplasm, so it's in contact with the mother's body chemistry. And once the egg is fertilized, that becomes eventually the child. And so anything in the cytoplasm of that egg from the mother can regulate the DNA in the nucleus to control what genes it's going to express and how it's going to express those. So the influence of the environment starts at the moment of fertilization.
And so you were talking a little bit earlier about the low road. So is that what you'd call a gut feeling? When people use their gut to make a decision, is it the low road that they take that goes directly to the amygdala?
We don't know that. I mean, the low road is a concept about sensory processing. How does the amygdala get its information? A gut feeling is a concept about what happens when you have an emotional response. Now, emotional response is almost by definition, in terms of the evolutionary definition, are unconscious, because the brain was unconscious before it was conscious in the sense of human consciousness. Now, human consciousness is all tied up with language and the prefrontal cortex and all kinds of things that only humans have or have especially well developed. So other animals may have some kind of consciousness in their own sense, but it's not going to be like human consciousness. So the automatic responses are the norm in the animal kingdom for emotional reactivity. So when an animal responds, it's basically always responding unconsciously. From the point of view of the human brain, when you have an unconscious response, that is always subject to being called a gut feeling, because it's always outside of consciousness and only interpreted in conscious. Now, a gut feeling would be an emotion, would be a decision that you make on the basis of the bodily response that you have. Now
that's pretty primitive.
It is.
That's what we're saying. So we say low road, we say primitive road. We mean you're not filtering it through the higher system, and you're not getting the parts of you that say, well, this happened in the past. You don't use your brain at all. You suddenly, if you're a man who's loaded with testosterone and you see a woman with a short skirt, you decide, oh, I got to go talk to her. Low road. Call it lower chakras.
I mean, it's dangerous to talk about, to go too far in these generalizations.
But I don't mean it as a judgment.
Right. But the gut feeling is, we talk about that in terms of the gut, but it's really everything that's unconscious in the brain. So
right.
we consciously become aware. Let's say if you cut your brain off and just had your head floating around, no gut at all, and you could keep it alive, your brain would be generating all sorts of signals that would infiltrate consciousness and would also be qualified as, gut feelings, but just because they're coming from an unconscious system.
Now, some people, however, go from that initial gut response to a higher level response, to another level response. And we call that, let's say we call it the high road for some reason. Not the high road for some reason.
Well, let's not use low and high road, because those have very specific meanings in my books, and I don't want to get things confused.
Well, what are those two meanings to you, low road and high road?
The low road is a direct input to the amygdala from the thalamus. The high road is an input from the sensory cortex. So it's very specific to sensory processing.
And
so,
in functioning, the high road versus the low road is...
So originally I described the low road as an unconscious activation of the amygdala and the high road as conscious, but I've retracted that view.
Oh, good, because I read the first book, I think.
Well, I've only retracted it recently, not in the second book either. So the low road and high road, I think, are both unconscious systems. But the difference is that the high road feeds into what becomes conscious. So the input to consciousness is the same as what goes to the amygdala from the high road, but it is not itself conscious.
Could you give me that one an example?
Yeah, so we used an example of an apple a while ago. So the shape and color of the apple, let's say the redness of the apple. Let's take an auditory example, because that's what we do most of our work on. The intensity of a sound can get to the amygdala through the low road very rapidly. In a rat, it takes 12 milliseconds from the onset of the sound to activate the amygdala through the low road. That's 1 second divided into 1,000 parts. After 12 of those little parts have responded, the rat's amygdala has already got the signal through the low road. It takes much longer for that stimulus to get to the amygdala from the high road, but then you have frequency and other kinds of more perceptual high-level characteristics that would allow you to identify, well, that's from a Beatles song or from a Mozart concerto or something, because you have now cognitive information feeding into what that stimulus is. But the amygdala is not getting Mozart and Beatles. It's just getting the music, the signal itself, the sensory and perceptual information independent of consciousness. That becomes conscious when you label it as Mozart or Beatles or whatever. So the it's a matter of what kind of sensory information the amygdala is processing.
And so going back to the man in your song who murdered his wife, is it that the information went from into the amygdala? It kind of took the low road, the rage.
I don't think the amygdala can commit a murder, basically.
Yes.
I don't believe in the amygdala defense. And the reason is what we know the amygdala can do is control hardwired reaction. So we need to make a distinction between reaction and action. So a reaction is freezing when you see a dangerous stimulus, jumping back, things like that. It's not picking up a knife, walking towards someone, and stabbing that person. You know, that is
a complicated, act.
Intentional, what we call instrumental act. It's an act that is carried out to achieve a goal. It's goal-directed behavior. And that has to come from areas like the striatum, or the neocortex in combination with the striatum. It's just a much more complicated thing. That's not to say that a crime of passion doesn't exist. It's just not an amygdala-based crime.
Mm-hmm.
So do you believe that if the courts decided to say that there's going to be one case where you're responsible and one case where you're not, like in France, crimes of passion are often forgiven? But if you thought about it in advance and it's premeditated, it's not forgiven.
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I mean, so you don't need the brain for that, right? You don't need to say anything about what part of the brain did it. It's if you can somehow prove that the person
did it
with a plan, you know, even thought about it before, then it's premeditated and it's not a crime of passion. If in the heat of the moment something happened, I don't know how you would ever prove that, but if you could prove it, then I think there would be some rationale.
And in teenagers, whose frontal lobes are not well myelinated and who are subject to taking risks that adults might not take, are they more inclined to have crimes of passion or to commit things where they haven't fully vetted it by the rest of their brains?
Right. So the prefrontal cortex is the the decider, so to speak. When Bush said, "I'm the decider," he was talking about his prefrontal cortex. And the teenage prefrontal cortex is poorly myelinated, undeveloped, so it has trouble regulating your emotional states. Now, one of the interesting things about the prefrontal cortex and emotions is that, as far as we know, there are no direct connections from the part of the prefrontal cortex called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is the working memory part where we think all these decisions are made. There are no connections from that part to the amygdala. So you've got, in order to willfully control your emotions, you've got to go through side roads and back streets to get to the amygdala. And that's kind of a hard process that you have to learn. And so even with the myelination of the prefrontal cortex, I think it's also a process of moral development, of maturation psychologically as well as neurologically, where you learn how to navigate through those poorly developed back roads and side streets to get to your amygdala. It's not simply about turning on the prefrontal cortex.
Mm-hmm.
We get to a point where you get like a mob behavior where something could get triggered and then continued by the fervor of a mob, right? You're considering that the same thing.
Mob behavior is, I think, related to the concept of emotional contagion. So emotions are like yawning. You know, if you see somebody else angry, you can easily get angry. Or if you see somebody else happy, you can get happy. You know, there's a famous study by Stanley Schachter and Jerry Singer in the 1960s. Schachter ended up at Columbia, and he was a big figure in the New York psychology world for a long time. But he did the study where he brought people into the laboratory, students, and put them in a room with either happy people or sad people or people who were in no particular mood, and saw what happened. If they were in the control group, nothing much happened. But if they got a shot of epinephrine before they went in, they adopted the mood of the group that they joined.
We're gonna continue that in just a minute.
Okay.
We have to take a short break, and when we do come back, we're going to come back with a little more example by music and then continue in our discussion. We'll be right back, I think.
Mind over matter, and this is about hope and longing and wanting to do something that we can't really do, which is use our minds to break down space and time and bring that lost love back together with us. Mind over matter, that's something I'm trying to do. Just a little physics that keeps me apart from you. Mind over matter, that's something I'm trying to do. Break down space and time, be together with you. I'm trying to will you here, find you wherever you are. Locate your body, your soul, pull you in from afar. Are you still in my time? Or have you slipped away? Have you gone forwards or back, living in another day? Where might you be? Different continent or on the sea? In the air, flying free, in a place heavenly. Wherever you are now, I'll use my mind to find. No amount of space or time keep you from being mine. Mind over matter, that's something I'm trying to do. Break down space and time, be together with you. Be together with you. Be together with you. Be together with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Joseph Ledoux, from his new album, The Amygdaloids.
The album is Theory of My Mind. The Amygdaloids are the band.
That's right. Okay. Theory, but you had two albums, right?
Yes, right.
Well, okay, so it brings us to the question. Mind over matter, how do I get to be with you? You know, understanding where we are physically and emotionally, and how we get, you know, I mean, how we get triggered. It's almost impossible to have a decent love relationship that's going to last for a long period of time if you're not conscious. I think, Joe, what do you think?
If you're not conscious.
If you're not conscious. And by that, I mean, if you're not thinking about what you're going through. Because if you just go on your gut.
I guess there are a couple of ways to answer that. One is that in the animal kingdom, there's not a lot of, loyalty in love life.
Right.
So, yeah, you may need some kind of higher order interaction to kind of keep things together.
Because, and they don't live as long.
Right.
Most animals.
Right. But they are promiscuous. They don't. They don't tend to be monogamous. There's a special group of voles that live out west.
The prairie voles. Prairie voles. Ones with the. The oxytocin.
Right. And they are monogamous. So they
but they also
exist.
Don't live long. I mean, they're four-year-old animals.
Yeah.
So, I mean, here we are, 70 years old, you know, married 25, 30 years.
Yep.
How do you keep it going?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, my wife and I have been married for, 1982, 28 years. And, it hasn't always been easy, but somehow we've managed to keep it going.
But does she, I don't mind, I don't know if you mind speaking about what she says, but does she think about her reactions?
Yes.
Does she
more
say,
than I do.
Does she say, oh, I can see I'm reacting this way, let me question it a little bit, let's go into it?
Well, I think we, we all have this response of when you're angry that it's hard to see the other side and to even see your side, right? So it's only in the kind of aftermath where you start to calm down that you can begin to kind of see, well, maybe I overreacted, or maybe you can talk her into seeing that she overreacted, but only after she's calmed down. But I think the point of that is that, you know, the chemicals, the hormones and the brain chemicals that are released in emotional states have a major purpose, which is to extend the duration of the state and to keep it intense. Those are the two main functions of hormones, to make sure that you don't, that's if you're facing a bloodthirsty beast, you have to remain focused, and the hormones keep you locked into that state and ensure that it's going to continue as long as the threat is present.
Okay, well, let's take that with premenstrual syndrome.
Okay,
let's take that. Now, let's say there's a negative mood that comes up, and you're saying very important to keep that mood going.
Well, that, the body evolutionarily.
Evolutionarily, the body is saying there's a threat here, so you have to be whichever way you are, which could be aggressive, attacking, could be, you know, irritable. And the worst thing you could do to somebody like that is to say to them, you know, you have PMS.
Right.
Because if you say that to them, it's like you got to get a double fight back.
So the, you know, I think we have to be careful about not thinking of the brain as, you know, a fait accompli. Our brain state is a fait accompli. While it is true that, as we were talking earlier, the brain can kind of bias, or these hormones, say, can kind of bias or push you in a certain direction, it's not that we have no control over it at all. You know, we, as we talked about, we have these back roads and side streets to control our emotions. It's hard, and there are going to be a lot of individual differences in terms of who can do it better in, you know, one individual versus another. So I don't think we can make too many generalizations, but the brain does, the brain and the body have ways of responding that constrain our opportunities and our behavioral repertoire in a certain situation. The other thing we need to consider, though, is that something like PMS may not be the function of those hormones, right? We see that in modern life as the way the hormonal state is playing out, but there may be an evolutionarily based function of those hormonal states that we're overlooking that had some purpose in addition to what it does to modern people.
For example?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, estrogen and testosterone and all of these hormones let's take the example of stress. So we think of cortisol as the stress hormone. When your cortisol is high, you're stressed out. So is the function of cortisol to make you stressed out? No. The role of cortisol is to help you adapt to a threatening or challenging situation. The consequence of that is that you feel stressed out if the hormone continues too long. But that's not its goal. Its goal is to help you cope. And I think in the case of PMS, it's probably the exact same thing. The hormones are there to help the woman cope with the situation that she's facing at the moment, the challenges that her body is encountering as a result of her point in the cycle. And one consequence of that is, you know, a side effect, in a sense, is what we call PMS. But that's not the function of those hormones. The function is to help adapt to the state that she's in. So from the practical point of view, as we just said, hormones can force you or constrain the way you act in a certain situation. And that's why, as you said, you know, telling someone, well, it's just PMS, that's why you're acting like that, doesn't help, because their mind is in a different state as a result of that hormonal condition.
Did you study bipolar disorder has your work approached that at all?
No. You know, I work on rats, and I started using fear as an example of emotion that because there were good animal models to study. So I did my PhD studying split-brain patients, humans with brain bisection to control epilepsy. Studied consciousness and emotion in those people. And I got interested in the question of, well, how can I study emotion more deeply, and decided that I had to do that in animal models because we didn't have imaging and all those kinds of tools that you have available today to study the human brain. So I had said, well, how can I study emotion in an animal? I said, well, there's this animal model called Pavlovian fear conditioning, where you give a rat a sound and you give him a sound that's paired with a shock, and he then becomes afraid of the sound. This was a way to take a stimulus that had no emotional meaning and give it an emotional meaning instantaneously. One trial, that's all you need. The rat learns that and he has the emotion forever, rest of his life. So it was a good tool, and I thought of it as a general tool for studying emotion, but the more I studied it, the more I came to realize I was studying fear rather than emotion in the big sense. And I always thought, well, maybe I'll get past fear in a couple of years and study other things. In fact, one of my goals originally was to try and analyze the good and the bad in the brain. I was going to use fear as the bad and reward as the good, but it got too complicated, and you know, I just got stuck on fear, and there's so much to learn about fear that I'll never get out of that.
William James presented a theory of the connection of the chemistry to the body, to the brain, to the emotions. Could you be a professor for a moment and tell us what he did?
Sure. Well, William James had the idea that you know, at the time, the common sense view, and it probably is still.
And what time was this? This is 1940?
Late
1890.
1890. Yeah, 1884, he wrote a paper in the journal called Mind. And then I think in 1890, he published his textbook, Principles of Psychology, which still has all of the basic findings that we talk about today. So they've just been kind of redone. So I was just on Charlie Rose, and Eric Kandel and I had a conversation about William James. And we concluded that, you know, all of modern psychology, or most of modern psychology, is a footnote to William James, is kind of cleaning up his ideas in a way. So in his theory of emotion, he said, well, we don't run away from the bear because we're afraid. We're afraid because we run. So he proposed this theory as an alternative to the common sense view at the time, and probably to the common sense view still today, which is that I'm afraid, therefore I run away. It's my feeling of being afraid that makes me run away. Why else would I run from a bear if I'm not afraid of it? Well, the more analytic way of thinking about it, and I don't mean psychoanalytic since we're in this place today, I mean the more detailed way of understanding what the brain is doing is that we know now that the brain can produce these automatic responses to danger, such as freezing or escape, running away, and so forth. And only after the fact do we become conscious of that and interpret it. So what James overlooked, though, when he said, okay, the body signature in fear, love, hate, joy, all of these is going to be different, and it's those signals coming back from the body that tell the brain what to feel. What he overlooked was how do those responses get triggered in the first place? So the brain has to first know that there's a dangerous situation, a love situation, a happy situation, or whatever out there, in order to produce an emotion-specific response. And that's really what I study. How does the brain trigger the initial reaction to an emotional stimulus?
So if you give somebody ecstasy, according to what they say about it, if they have ecstasy, they see the bear and they go, oh, wow, and they don't run away. They say, oh, wow,
yeah, right.
How beautiful.
Yeah, that's a good point.
How did that get changed?
How did what get changed?
How did that reaction get changed? How can you look at the same thing as frightening one minute and awesome as the next minute?
Well, the brain is a conglomeration of lots. It's a society. Marvin Minsky wrote a book called The Society of Mind and talked about all these different kinds of mental processes that are simultaneously going on. And the brain is like that too. It's talk about the society of the brain. There's many, many systems and structures and things going on simultaneously in parallel.
In different parts of the brain.
Different parts.
So we could have how many parts of the brain are there? Like a dozen, roughly?
We shouldn't talk about parts. We need to talk about systems.
Okay.
And when we talk about systems, we're not talking about parts so much because imagine you've got, say, 100 neurons in a structure like the amygdala, and each of those neurons has 1,000 connections and 1,000 inputs from other neurons. So what's important are the synapses on neurons, not the neurons themselves. So by virtue of the different synaptic connections of those same 100 neurons, those 100 neurons can do 1,000 different things, you know. So the and just amplify that, multiply that out by the millions of neurons in the brain and across many, many systems in the brain, and you got a tremendously complex thing. But we can isolate certain functions. We can say, well, the amygdala is especially important for fear, probably other emotions as well, many other emotions, positive things and so forth. But we understand its role in fear best. But when you take a drug like ecstasy, you're not just changing the amygdala. You're changing the biochemistry of the entire brain. And that's going to reset a lot of circuits, including the amygdala. And it's going to just change, you know, what's going on altogether.
So it's a society of ganglia, in effect.
A society of synapses.
Of synapses, okay. And so these synapses, in their one form, they're going to do one thing, right? If you give them a chemical,
yes,
and that chemical affects the protein synthesis at the synapse, it may change the reaction.
Doesn't even have to affect protein synthesis. The chemicals most people are familiar with in the brain are things like serotonin, mm-hmm, dopamine, norepinephrine, acetylcholine, and so forth. These are called neuromodulators. They contrast with neurotransmitters like glutamate and GABA, which are information processors. So imagine a string of neurons from your eye to your visual cortex that are responsible for you seeing an apple on the table. You've got to get information from the eye to the thalamus, from the thalamus to the cortex, and through a variety of circuits within the cortex before you can see that stimulus. So that's a kind of linear chain of information processing that builds up that apple in your brain. But at each of those steps, chemicals like norepinephrine, dopamine, serotonin modulate what the glutamate and GABA are doing as they transmit information through that circuit.
So if you're having a deep psychotic reaction, like let's say you're paranoid, suddenly the apple has worms in it, and it's coming out to get you, and you see faces. How did that happen?
Well, that's a much more complicated example.
The same thing.
I really don't – I couldn't tell you how hallucinations start, but there's an interesting story about hallucinations, which goes back to pre-World War II, which is a couple of German scientists, Kluver and Busse, were studying. They wanted to understand how hallucinogenic drugs work. So they took the drugs and had hallucinations. And they said, well, if we can understand hallucinations, we need to understand the visual cortex. So they made lesions in the monkey brain and found that when they lesioned certain parts of the visual cortex, or the temporal lobe and the occipital lobe, they caused blindness. Other parts, they cause psychic blindness. By psychic blindness, they meant that the animals could still see the objects. They didn't bump into objects and stuff. They weren't blind, but the objects lost their emotional significance. Later research by Larry Weiskranz, who's now at Oxford, discovered that damage to the amygdala was responsible for this psychic blindness. So the animals lost their fear of humans and of snakes. They lost their ability to distinguish which animals they should have sex with. So that these were male monkeys. They started trying to have sex with other male monkeys, which they hardly ever do, or with even other species. So the emotional significance of the stimulus was lost. And all of this started from an interest in hallucinations.
So the emotions actually influence our emotions influence memory.
Yeah, emotions are very important in the release of hormones like cortisol and norepinephrine and epinephrine from the adrenal gland. And these hormones cortisol gets back into the brain, but norepinephrine and epinephrine have to get into the brain indirectly. But in either case, the hormones are able to modulate the ability of structures like the hippocampus to store what we call declarative or conscious memories. So let's say you're driving down the road, you have an accident, you hit your head on the steering wheel, and you're in pain and bleeding and so forth. A few days later, and the horn gets stuck on. A few days later, you hear the sound of a horn. So through Pavlovian conditioning, your amygdala has developed a fear response to the horn. So your blood pressure is rising, your hormones are being released. All of that is flooding through your brain. Simultaneously, you remember where you were, who you were with, why you were in the car. That's your hippocampal memory. The emotional memory is from the amygdala. It's an unconscious response. The memory about the emotion is in the hippocampus. Now, in your consciousness, those are seamlessly fused together, because as soon as you have that conscious memory of the accident, the memory about the emotion, the hormones are starting to come in and amplify that memory and make it more brilliant, more conscious, more significant in your consciousness, and restore that as a more significant event. So there used to be this, well, there still is this concept of flashbulb memories, memories that are just really strong and vivid because of the emotional arousal that occurs. We now know from work by Liz Phelps at NYU and other researchers that emotional memories are not more accurate. We think of them as more accurate, but they're not more accurate. They're more vivid. So, you know, everyone is of our age knows what they were doing when Kennedy was shot. Now we'll remember other things. You know, the most important things in society in your life, you tend to remember where you were when you heard them. So the idea was that, well, all these memories are being really burned into the brain in a very specific and informational way. But we now know that the information is very weak, but the vividness is there. So you think you remember very strongly, but you don't. And this is this was really proven in studies done after the space Shuttle Challenger explosion, where the people there, psychologists got there immediately, tested the people for what they saw on that day, brought them in a year later, tested their memory, brought them in 5 years later, tested their memory. The memory at 1 year and 5 years hardly matched what they remembered at the day of the scene. So we always have to, in terms of eyewitness testimony in crimes, we always have to really be careful about how we interpret these things and how much weight we put on them.
Since you've discovered the role, or since you've been through all of this, has it helped you live better personally? Has it made your emotional life freer?
I don't think so. You know, emotions, one of my songs that you asked me to play, which I wasn't prepared to play because I hadn't done it in a while, it's called An Emotional Brain. It says an emotional brain is a hard thing to tame. You know, it really is. It's a separate brain from your conscious cognitive brain, and you've got to use those back roads and side streets to get to it. It's hard.
So therefore?
Therefore, even though I know all this stuff about the brain and emotion, I don't think it necessarily. Maybe it helps me a little bit.
I think it must help you a little bit, because one of the things you know is the difference between you as the scientist, writer, and that's one kind of attention you get.
Right.
And you the musician.
Right.
And I'm sure if you didn't pay attention to your own self and what yourself is responding to, you wouldn't have reached out and said, I'm going to be both. I'm going to do what I want to do. I think it does give you freedom.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that we get trapped
right
in our primitive brain.
Right. Oh, we do, definitely. I mean, you know, as I said, the prefrontal cortex, where working memory is, has very little connectivity to the amygdala, but the amygdala has massive connectivity to the cortex. So it's very easy for our emotions to control our thoughts, but not so easy for our thoughts to control our emotions.
Thank you very much for being with us. Sherry, thank you so much for doing the research to get it. Lauren, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
You know, this has been a lot of fun. We're going to sign out with that piece that he wouldn't rehearse. Where is it? If I could find it. Here we go. Back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. And remember, the name of the album, you know, we should mention the book also. A brilliant book, The Emotional Brain by Joseph Ledoux, L-E-D-O-U-X. Definitely worth having and reading and digesting. And the name of the group, The Amygdaloids. Latest album, Theory of the Mind. Theory of My Mind. Sit and wait for another trigger. Emotional brain is a hard thing to tame. It just won't stay in its place. Every time I think I got it, it gives me another face. Happy, sad, disgusted, or mad. These are the things it shows. I keep trying to rain.
Ciao, sono Letizia e quando sono a New York ascolto WBAI su 99.5 FM e quando torno in Italia ascolto WBAI sul web wbai.org.
Hi, my name is Anila Mohammed. When I'm in New Jersey, I always have my radio tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI. And when I'm back home in Pakistan, I listen on the web at wbai.org. Assalamu alaikum. Mera naam Anila Mohammed hai. Jab main New Jersey mein hoti hoon, to main hamesha 99.5 FM WBAI ko sunti hoon. Aur jab apne mulk Pakistan mein hoti hoon, to hamesha WBAI ki website wbai.org ko sunti hoon. Assalamu alaikum. Mera naam Anila Mohammed hai. Te jadon main New Jersey honi ha, te hamesha 99.5 FM WBAI nu sunni ha. ਤੇ ਜਦੋਂ ਆਪਣੇ ਮੁਲਕ ਪਾਕਿਸਤਾਨ ਹੋਣੀ ਆ ਤੇ ਹਮੇਸ਼ਾ WBAI ਦੀ ਵੈਬਸਾਈਟ wbai.org ਨੂੰ ਸੁਣਨੀ ਆ।
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.
Again.
Always.
Arms asked.
Away.
Behind.
Bit black.
Bloom.
Bloom, 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 bloom.
You're listening to a list of words most frequently used in James Joyce's masterpiece, Ulysses.
Hear these words in the order Joyce wrote them on
Radio Bloomsday, our annual celebration of James Joyce.
And the novel that changed the literary future.
Radio Bloomsday with Alec Baldwin, Jerry Stiller, Ann Mira, Charles Bush, Kate Vaughk, Bob Dishy, Bob Odenkirk.
And Carrot O'Brien as Molly Bloom.
Lord love man.
Men might mother Mr.
Mulligan.
That's Must Radio Bloomsday, Wednesday, June 16th from 7 p.m. to the wee hours of Thursday.
Radio Bloomsday, June 16th, starting at 7 p.m.
Here on WBAI.
Even.
Still street. Take.
Tell thing.
Think, though, thought.
Three time told.
Took two.
Hi, I'm Rosie Perez, and this is WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio is a listener-supported, listener-driven station, so it's essential that you, the listener, make your voice heard in our upcoming 2010 WBAI local elections. In order to vote, you must become a member or renew your membership by pledging $25 to WBAI before June 30th.